Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome. Happy Sunday, or whichever day you're watching or listening to the show. As lockdown gradually eases, mayhem continues. There was a lot to talk about today. General corruption, sleaze at the heart of power. And we've got some great guests to actually talk about what this all means, what's actually happening. A lot of politics, particularly in the political lobby, lobby journalists, reduce what happens to a psychodrama. It's like an episode of EastEnders. We're going to try and avoid doing that, especially avoiding this being the Dominic Cummings show, which all too often is what this becomes. Now, what is going on? Let's just give a gist, a flavour of some of the things we're going to talk about. And then we've got wider themes. We're going to look at the big picture. So you've got Dominic Cummings, who, to be fair, is one of the most unpopular figures in the country, but he claims there was an unethical, foolish, possibly illegal plan to get Tory donors to secretly fund the refurbishment of Boris Johnson's flat, who possibly got a loan from a Tory donor. Liz Truss, the cabinet minister, was pretty cagey when asked about that on the Sunday broadcasts. Now, Cummings is talking about a dossier, and I think this is particularly important, which could damn Boris Johnson over delayed November lockdown, which we'll talk about later. But if you remember, Sage on the 21st of September called for a circuit breaker lockdown in order to avoid catastrophe. That circuit breaker didn't take place. Cases surged, so did deaths. A new variant, of course, was allowed to enter the wider circulation, which was always the risk as cases multiplied. And more people died in the second wave than died in the first wave. Now, Cummings himself is reportedly privately said to be worried about him going to prison because of vote leave and things that went on in government. Boris Johnson's special envoy to the Gulf, a close ally, Lord Lister, resigned after scrutiny of his private sector interests. Now, he helped award £4 billion in property deals for firms he went to work for, brokered a property deal while paid by both buyer and seller. He owns his shares in companies that won £1 million in government and NHS contracts since he joined Number 10. We've had, of course, the former Prime Minister, David Cameron, who has done his very best to out-disgrace his predecessor, Tony Blair, lobbying ministers over the now-collapsed Greensill, Lord Dyson lobbying Boris Johnson, massive questions over contracts for PPE and other COVID-19 contracts. That is a lot, a stench of sleaze and indeed corruption. And actually, according to today's polling, 40% of us think that the Conservatives are corrupt. There's a bit of a caveat there because the same poll gives the Tories an 11-point lead, which raises the question, have people basically just factored this in? Then they voted for Boris Johnson. They knew what they were getting themselves into without being a bit resigned to this and a bit defeatist. Has this, you know, is this something which the electorate have just taken as read? We'll be talking about that later on. But what's really important about this, other than, you know, moving away from psychodrama and indeed party politics, is our democracy. It's about the nature of our democracy. It's about protecting our democracy, a democracy in which the people are supposed to be sovereign and in which private interests should not be able to buy influence based on their wealth. Now, of course, we know that's what happens, but we're going to talk about that in detail and also what we can do about it. How can we actually take on corruption, sleaze, and save our democracy? So we've got a lot to talk about today with two great guests. For those supporting the podcast and the channel through Patreon, we really appreciate it. You help decide what we talk about, the subjects we go into, the people we talk to. Last week, Robert Lindsay, Jamie Carragher, very eclectic. Next week, we're talking to Lord Buckethead. But also we're going to Hartlepool, tomorrow. We're doing a documentary in Hartlepool about what's going on in that community. You've made that possible. I have had a haircut, as people are noting. That was, I think, a looming national catastrophe, which has finally been dealt with, so at least there's that. Right, okay, that's enough of me. Let's bring in our two first brilliant guests. Tamazin Cave, who's co-author of A Quiet Word and a brilliant campaigner, and Daniel Bruce, who is the chief executive of Transparency International. Hello, how are you both doing?
Hello.
Hi. Good.
So, where to begin? Now, I just want your general take on some of the things I just spoke about, because there was a lot. There's a lot going on there. Daniel, what do you think? What's your general overview? Your general take on what is currently going on, and obviously is on the front of several newspapers.
I think you're very wise to try and avoid the psychodrama that we've inevitably seem to have sort of stumbled and tripped into over the last few weeks. And, you know, I actually am struggling to remember everything that's happened in the last 7 days in terms of the various elements of the lobbying scandal related to Greensill, the Dyson text messages that you've mentioned. We came out with a big report on Thursday into PPE procurement and corruption red flags in that area, which I'm sure we'll go into. And then we've seen the whole Downing Street flat business. And I think the risk that we have in a situation like this is that the other thing I've lost count of, in addition to the specific allegations in specific areas, is how many inquiries have now been set up, or how many inquiries have now been called for, and into what and by whom and with what terms of reference and so on and so forth, and how long are they going to take to report? And inquiries are necessary, of course, a lot of the time, but also we've now got this very fragmented picture around, you know, all of these kind of bitty allegations and issues. And I think what needs to happen is we need to be able to take a great big step back from all of that and look at what evidence and history and research already tells us about what is wrong with the system when it comes to our defenses against corruption, when it comes to the preservation of integrity in public life. And, you know, I would contend, Transparency International would contend, that we know what could be done already. What is missing at the minute, it would seem, is the political will to make some of those changes happen.
Tamazin, what's your general take?
Yeah, it's quite hard to keep up with all this. It's literally daily, and there's something new. But if you follow this kind of story, so lobbying stories around sort of influence and persuasion, these have been going on for months, and all throughout the Johnson government. And I don't know. I'm slightly more optimistic. As somebody who's kind of campaigned for transparency and lobbying for the best part of a decade, I'm really optimistic, because I think what these are doing are giving us glimpses of how the world inside Westminster and Whitehall actually works on a daily basis. So rather than kind of hone in on the particular, and I think this is important, I think some of the inquiries will be revealing, particularly into the Greensill affair. But I think what they show us is that there is a culture within Westminster and Whitehall, which is entirely at odds with our perception of what our government should be doing and how it should be acting. And so the more windows that are opened onto that, the more we get a kind of a clear understanding of, yes, There is something going on in there that normalises this behaviour, because I guarantee that David Cameron didn't think he was doing anything wrong. He saw his former colleagues that, you know, when he was in government, and they're all working in lobbying agencies now, or they're working for corporations. And he thought, well, I'm going to get on that train, because it's just normal behaviour, the kind of activity that he was engaged in. So I am optimistic that we are getting a much better public understanding, and I think the public understood largely what, you know, that we've been evicted from decision making and replaced by private, narrow, mainly corporate interests. But I think the more we understand, I mean, it'd be better if instead of having all these little spotlights put on it, you had a bloody great floodlight and we could actually just see the whole lot. But it's an understanding of the sort of disconnect between what goes on in government and what we perceive government is for, that I think is, I always think it's good.
So, I mean, just talking about, you raised obviously David Cameron lobbying Greensill. We've had Lord Dyson. I mean, Daniel, I suppose, I mean, it's tricky kind of without feeding that sense of resignation I spoke about before. I mean, how, you know, isn't that just something which happens a lot, that this happens under all governments of all stripes? You get powerful rich people with influence who are well connected, who use their wealth, influence and connections to exert influence over government. So actually, is what happened with David Cameron and, for example, Lord Dyson stuff, is there anything new about it? But equally, that itself should be damning, surely, because that is a damning indictment of a democracy if that kind of thing is so commonplace.
Yeah, I think you're right. The first thing to say is, yeah, this has touched parties of all stripes down the decades in different ways in one way or another. And, you know, let's not forget that, you know, up in Liverpool at the minute, we've seen a significant incident around alleged corruption in bribery and local planning control, for example, that led to the mayor being arrested. And you know, there's lots to learn from that affair. So, and the risk with the kind of psychodrama is that this all becomes very politicized very quickly. But you're absolutely right. This is something which has spanned multiple governments over multiple parliaments, and there have been multiple missed opportunities to make some changes that would make a difference. And the problem is that, you know, the I think we counted in the region of 25 to 30 lobbying related scandals over the last decade or so, where the lobbying activity had not been caught by the statutory register of consultant lobbyists. So that shows you that there is a gaping hole in the system for the regulation of this area of activity, for the regulation of that culture, which I think is an absolutely key point. So actually, if the kind of the norms around it are going to lead to a culture where the loopholes are consistently, you know, certain behaviors fall through the cracks, then we've got to plug those loopholes. And I think one of the most striking things, problems that we have with the lobbying oversight today, is that the register that is in place, that was introduced by David Cameron himself, only refers to consultant lobbyists. Now, 90% of lobbying professionals work on the payroll of the organisations that they are lobbying for. So if you've got a system that is only set up to regulate 10% of the industry that's doing the lobbying, then of course stuff's going to fall between the cracks, whether it's purposeful, whether it's culture, whether it's just kind of standards and norms that have been established. So the evidence is telling us we've got to tighten up the system.
Tamerlan, I mean, you spent so many years looking at lobbying, how it works, how it operates. Do you just want to give us a flavour of how, what, you know, how big an industry it is, and how it exerts influence in position in the world of politics?
Yeah, okay. So if you start from the beginning, which is lobbying in and of itself, in theory, is not a bad thing. I'm a lobbyist, or I was a lobbyist. I was lobbying for lobbying transparency regulations. And it basically is any act that is trying to influence the decisions of government. So when you write to your MP, you are trying to influence the decisions of government. And everybody should be able to do it because, you know, you want the government to listen to outside interests. It's what happens in practice that is the problem, in that we have a £2 billion roughly, that's the scale of it, we don't really know, but £2 billion influence industry, which is entirely full of political insiders that give mainly corporations and foreign governments, that's where the money comes from, give them access to politicians to the, such an extent that they make decisions entirely in the narrow interest of whoever's paying. And there are various, there's nothing mystical about how lobbying works. It's there is a set of tools, and it is the manipulation of the media and getting these kind of third party spokesmen out into the press. And, you know, whether it's surrounding our politicians with the messages that you want them to hear and excluding everybody else. So there's a lot of kind of oppo, kind of anti campaigner stuff that the industry does as well. But they effectively have managed to rig the system to such an extent that the public interest has been largely evicted from decision making. Now, you talked about the you talked about the statutory register of lobbyists and the failings of it. It was entirely designed to fail. So for 10 years, I campaigned for It's a very small step. It's a transparency measure, but one that they have in lots of other countries around the world. And effectively, this register should, it would require lobbyists on a quarterly basis to say who they are, who they're lobbying for, whom they're meeting in government, and what they're seeking to influence. So David Cameron would have to say, I'm David Cameron, former Prime Minister. I'm lobbying for Greensill. I am meeting Rishi Sunak, and I'm trying to get loads of, you know, access to this COVID lending scheme. And then you, what it means is that you can see. So effectively, all it does is we know what's going on inside these rooms. The rooms are secret at the moment. Lobbying is best done, is most effective when nobody can watch what's happening. Because if you're in the room, then you suddenly go, well, hang on a sec, that, well, that benefits that business, but it's not very good for all the workers, or it's not very good for the environment, or whatever it is. So you want to do it in secret. And all it does is it says, right, you're in the room, open the curtains a little bit, let us see what's going on in the room, and then we can discuss it. Because, and I think the most telling thing was, when we were lobbying for this statutory register, they deliberately, and it was an absolute deliberate act, they went through the entire rigmarole of legislating to bring in what was effectively a pretend register to say that they ticked the box. And when it went through Parliament, I mean, it's worth going back and reading Hansard and looking at the debates, because MPs knew this and they told them. I mean, it was called a dog's breakfast. And, you know, I mean, that's it was roundly kind of condemned when it went through. And they brought it in order to kind of make the problem go away. But it obviously hasn't, and it won't, because we keep getting these scandals. But I think the most telling thing is the fact that they effectively, by bringing in rubbish, nonsense, pretend regulation, is they're saying, do you know what? We don't want to open the curtains and you're not allowed to see into the room. And I think it's that act of kind of denying people a meaningful way of engaging in politics, because it's so much more than who texted who and, you know, the wallpaper of David Cameron's new flat. And I was asked on the radio the other day about, you know, I was like outraged about Dyson's texts. And I'm not outraged about that, but I am absolutely full of rage about the things that matter. The things like, we are not going to get action on climate whilst lobbyists are for the oil and gas industry are in this closed room with our governments, or on housing policy, or, you know, the NHS is going to continue to be opened up to the private sector whilst these are all secret. And that's what I feel rage about, is the fact that lobbying is this kind of, I sort of describe it as a gateway issue. Unless you can tackle lobbying, you aren't going to tackle all the other things that need tackling, where they have been, these issues have been entirely dominated to by these narrow, mainly corporate interests. There you go, rant over.
Great rant. I love a rant. A very eloquent rant at that. Daniel, before I bring in the COVID report, which Transparency International has brilliantly worked on, I mean, just tell us a bit in terms of, because Transparency looks at very broad rate UK, international of issues of corruption. And I suppose in terms of, you know, we're talking about lobbying, but there's the revolving door, there's party donors who end up in the House of Lords. Do you just want to tell us some of those elements of this story, if you like, and how they work in modern Britain?
Yeah, absolutely. So the lobbying piece is part of this kind of fragmented puzzle, as what I've, as I said, described as our defences against corruption, the safeguards for the preservation of public integrity. And we've got a way to go in the UK at the minute. And there are other similar democracies, places like Canada, Ireland and the US, who are doing better than us in many areas in terms of the instruments that they've got in place. I think we have a particularly concerning situation around the oversight of the ministerial code at the moment. For example, the independent advisor on the code quit at the end of last year after the Priti Patel investigation. That person has not been replaced. The job has not been advertised. As a result, declarations of ministerial interests have not been released for months on end. It is a system which essentially is enacted at the will of the Prime Minister of the day. It is entirely in the gift of the executive how it is used, and we believe that that needs to be changed, and it needs to be put on a statutory footing, and there need to be a ladder of sanctions available to an independent autonomous body that oversees parliamentary integrity. Let's look at another area. Freedom of information is really important for transparency and accountability of government. We have legislation Which came in place just over 20 years ago. And since then, there has been a steady decline in the amount of freedom of information requests which are granted at all or in full compared to a decade ago. Regulation of business appointments. We've heard a lot about ACOBA, Lord Pickles regulator, in the last few weeks. And again, you know, that's generated a lot of sort of colour and anger around the Greensill allegations. But all that ACOBA can do is issue a strongly worded letter if it finds any misconduct. So there are multiple bits of the defences and the safeguards that need clear and obvious improvements. I could go on, but you get the general picture. So it's integrity, it's business appointments, it's lobbying, it's political donations, and so on and so forth. And all of these little fragmented bits all need considerable work to move them forward. And what I'm getting a little bit kind of fatigued with is that every time we get the latest bit of this puzzle comes out, a government spokesperson will sort of say, okay, well, we have no plans to change this at this point in time. Well, why? Because the evidence is saying that you need to. And, you know, we've got to move the conversation beyond that.
Yeah, Tamsin, before I was going to bring up PPE, but I mean, what should, because you've looked at various aspects, not just lobbying. So how does it all fit together in terms of revolving door, which I know is something you're interested in?
The revolving door. If you, again, come back to lobbying not being a kind of a mystical, mythical, kind of magical activity, the revolving door is a technique. So if you are a business and you want to, I don't know, get a tax break or a NHS contract, or normally lobbyists lobby for one or two reasons. It's either government presents a risk to their business, so that could be regulation or whatever, or it represents an opportunity, so that could be a massive contract or a tax break or whatever it is. So if you are if you want to influence government, it's kind of human nature. What you need is somebody who knows government and you know the people in government. So the quickest way to shortcut that is to hire somebody who's just come out of government. So that's why you get the lobbying industry, which is entirely full of special advisors, former ministers, senior civil servants, anybody who's basically been in government and has the contacts like David Cameron and can just phone them up. But it's not, I mean, it's, you've got, I looked at the, there is a voluntary register of lobbyists and I looked at it the other day, and there's one particular firm that employs, it's got Amber Rudd, it's got Oliver Letwin, and it's got one of the other baldy men, I think it's William Hague, and it employs these three heavyweights. And you think of the access that they could give to the corporate clients of Tenio, which most of which we don't know. So the revolving door is just a strategy for, you know, kind of, as the late Paul Flynn MP said, you know, it's advantaging the already advantaged. I mean, that's kind of how it works. I think in terms of, I mean, I like the way that TI is just so forensically into the detail, but I think it's kind of important to kind of think of other ways that this can be combated. And sometimes I give talks on corporate lobbyists, and I will sit and talk to people for an hour, and we get to the end of the talk and physically everybody's done that. And they're just, you know, you basically say to people, there is this huge great Goliath there and it's massive and it's corrupting our politics and you can't really do anything about it. But I've had a really privileged position in that I go and sit in lots of meetings where lobbyists are present, and you hear about how they talk and the threats that they face. And the bit that never gets told is the fact that lobbyists, they're not all powerful, and there are some things that we can do. And the one thing that I've learned is that they hate, and the threat the biggest threat is when people gather together, so protest, organized campaign groups, things like that. And I think what sometimes is missing in all this conversation, and I wanted to get it in before we stopped, is that there is an awful lot of power that that people have by coming together and shouting loudly. So ignore Priti Patel, get out on the streets, that kind of thing. But I just wanted, we can talk about corporate lobbying and it seems kind of all powerful. And when you sit in the room with them, I remember when Occupy was on, you know, they were absolutely shitting themselves basically because there was all the tax haven crowd and whatever. They were like, this isn't funny anymore. The Telegraph are talking about tax avoidance and this isn't funny. So they're not all powerful. That's kind of what I would say.
So Daniel, I just want to ask you about this report which you've done on Transparency International on PPE procurement, and there's been a lot about this in certain newspapers over the last few weeks, but this really goes into great detail. You've identified 73 contracts worth more than £3.7 billion that raise one or more red flags for possible corruption, 24 contracts worth £1.6 billion awarded to those with known political connections to the Conservative Party. So you want to talk us through a bit?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity for the plug. The report is called Track and Trace. It's very extensive. You'll find it on the Transparency International UK website. And it's a really striking read. It's a forensic analysis of 1,000 contracts, £18 billion. We believe it is the most comprehensive study of public procurement in the UK during the COVID-19 crisis so far. And the methodology here is really very straightforward. We are objectively, dispassionately analysing all of these contracts, those that are available, because there have been some serious issues with late reporting of contracts, which has been well publicised. And we've looked at those contracts against well-established red flags for possible corruption or conflict of interest. Red flags are not created by us, but by the likes of the OECD. And we come up with this figure that 20% of that £18 billion spend, we feel, had vulnerability to corruption. I should stress, we're not saying that they were corruptly awarded. That's why we are saying that they need further investigation. And that shouldn't be controversial. On the basis of this objective piece of research based on open source data. The other very significant finding that we do have is that the so-called VIP lane, which many of your viewers will have heard about, which was first identified by the National Audit Office at the end of last year, this kind of contract triaging system that was set up by the government. So it stopped doing open public procurement, it used the emergency legislation, and then it set up this VIP lane so that friends and contacts of ministers, of MPs, ostensibly of all parties and political stripes, could submit their referrals into the VIP lane for a bit of pre-triaging. What we find is that the VIP lane wasn't widely advertised and known about across the House, across the civil service in the way that it should have been and via the normal channels. And when you analyse the contracts that went through that and were successful, it does appear to be a significant inherent bias towards politically connected contractors connected to the party of government. Now, the government response to that has been, well, all contracts went through the normal 8-step due diligence process and the system was widely advertised. It's really important to remember that the 8-step process came after the triaging, after the referrals, and we could not find the evidence that the VIP lane was widely advertised. So we continue to call for today for full transparency over who knew what about it and when. Does it still exist? If so, why? And it needs to be shut down and we need to get back to proper public procurement and open standards of contracting in order to ensure that public money is spent wisely and well.
And Daniel, I know you've got to go. So just finally, what do we do about all of this? Based on what's happened in the last few weeks, what are the kind of key demands you'd like people to be organising around?
So I think there are some potentially positive recommendations in the government's green paper on procurement. There is some learning which comes through that. So, you know, groups like us who get into the sort of technical weeds around this will continue to push forward and say, actually, you know, this really matters. This is, we're talking about eye-watering amounts of public money here. We're all going to pick up the tab for this in our taxes over the coming years. This isn't some weird, obscure thing. And it isn't, I must stress, this cannot be made a mutually exclusive debate between the need to save lives in an emergency and the need to spend money quickly. Ukraine and Colombia were publishing their contracts within 24 hours, whereas some of ours are more than 100 days late against the deadline. Sweden massively increased contracting and procurement transparency at the height of the pandemic. So it didn't have to be this way. And I think the most important thing is that we have full and frank analysis, audit, and lessons learned from how these massive amounts of money were spent during the crisis, and have that full accountability retrospectively for what has happened over the last year, as well as ensuring that actually you put in place the mechanisms to ensure that, heaven forbid, if we end up on a crisis of this scale again, that we wouldn't see the same sort of risks and challenges to public spending that we have done. And that's the key bit. There has to be accountability for what's happened. It's not just about making sure that we get it right again next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And I want to bring in Tamazin just to say what you think should happen next, but I'll let Daniel go because I know you've got to skip off. So thank you so much for joining us. It was really, really good to have your insight and to talk about that brilliant report, Track and Trace, which people should look up, download, read, digest, and act upon. But I really appreciate it, Daniel, so I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. Pleasure being here. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yes, thank you. Tamazin, yeah, so it'd just be great to hear what are the kind of demands that people should be organising around.
I mean, the really easy one, but it is a really small step, is get a decent register of lobbyists, which is the driest thing to campaign around, having done it. But it's this getting the flipping curtains open so we can see into the room. And it means that we will have a better public debate around. Sorry, my dog has just arrived on my...
Oh, hello! What's the dog? What's he called?
She, Fizz. She's just a... if I don't hold her, she'll bark. Anyway, so I think a statutory register of lobbyists, a decent one, a proper one, is a must-have. They have them all over the world. There's absolutely no reason. And actually now quite a lot of the lobbying industry is asking for a proper one as well. It's got to include all the lawyers. It's got to include the management consultancies and anybody working in-house like Cameron. But beyond that, I think, I mean, that is about scrutiny. But I think keep following these stories and keep unearthing these stories. Byline's doing some really good stuff. Navarra talk about it. There's various people in the press, and I really enjoyed the, was it last week where you had Robert and Gabriel on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
The journalists. I mean, the press scrutiny is absolutely key. The problem is that the lobbying industry is heavily kind of intertwined with the media. So they're all in the same room together, a lot of them, and lobbyists are very good sources of information for journalists. And so there's this kind of relationship there that kind of predisposes journalists not to write about what are effectively pretty good political sources. But so scrutiny. And then the final thing, I think, is just not to be naive about, not that anybody would think that this is just a problem confined to the Tory party, but it is. I mean, lobbyists basically are doing it for very practical reasons. Lobbying is another way of making money for their clients. So whether it's a tax break or a contract or whatever it is, and they don't really care who is in government. And I will get to the exception in a minute. They don't really care who's in government. So they will at the moment be, and they are surrounding Starmer, and he has quite a lot of lobbyists in his team. Manderson's come back on board. I notice he runs a firm. But they will be targeting Labour in order for Labour to give them what they want and make sure that Labour is on side. The exception obviously was Jeremy Corbyn, and it was quite funny reading the lobbying press when he was around, because they were in bits because they didn't know him. Nobody had spent years making tea for him and schmoozing him and blah, 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 apart from the unions, obviously, who are also lobbyists. But the commercial lobbying industry didn't know him from Adam. So they were like, Jesus, what do we do? How do we actually get to this guy? Because we haven't spent years cultivating the contacts with him and anybody else, you know, anybody who's done his photocopying. So just be mindful that as you know, they're putting a lot of effort into influencing the Johnson government. At the same time, they will be schmoozing the Labour Party.
Tamsin, thank you so, so much. You are brilliant as ever. Your work, for those who haven't followed Tamsin's work, is absolutely superb. I drawn on it for my last book. I interviewed you for The Establishment, which was, oh my word, about 7-8 years ago. Wow.
It was.
It's been a long few years, but it's always great to be able to draw on your fantastic expertise. So thank you for joining us on a Sunday. And I look forward to seeing you maybe in real life at some point.
Yeah. God. Thanks.
And lots of love to the dog as well.
Cheers,
love.
Bye.
See you later. Cheers. They were both fantastic, so really chuffed to have them both. I'm going to bring in now the brilliant journalist. He's very, very, very good, and you should follow his work immediately. He's Adam Bienkov from Business Insider. Hello, mate. How you doing?
All right, how you doing?
In a shed. That's where your similarities begin and end with David Cameron. Good. just to kick, I mean, like, Dominic Cummings' psychodrama, in my head, I kind of thought, avoid. What's your general take on it? The whole Cummings thing at the moment.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've all just got to be careful when talking about these kind of stories about Dominic Cummings, because I think some of the things that he raised in his blog on Friday were quite significant. The allegations about Boris Johnson's attempt to use Conservative Party donors to pay for the renovation of his Downing Street residence, they are very serious. And he potentially does have some more serious allegations about the Prime Minister's actions around lockdown last year. So I think those are significant, but I think there is always a danger when Cummings gets involved in a story that it goes from being a very serious story about sort of government incompetence or cronyism into this kind of psychodrama or soap opera about who Boris Johnson does and doesn't get on with in Downing Street, who Dominic Cummings didn't get on with, Boris Johnson's fiance, and God help us, their dog, you know. And these are the kind of issues that it kind of goes from being a very serious, substantive story about government procurement to being something more of a kind of soap opera, more about personality. And I think a lot of these stories have come out from the work of great journalists, many of whom are in the lobby. But it's fair to say that there was a definite spike in interest among the British press on Friday as soon as Dominic Cummings got involved, and lots more people are writing about it now than they were before. But the focus tends to be more on this kind of, I mean, you've seen that if you look at the Sunday papers today, it's full of sort of briefings in between Downing Street and Cummings, and about that. It's more kind of personality focused than it is on the actual substance of the story.
I mean, I did think what was particularly significant was about what happened last autumn. So the 21st of September, Sage declared that, they favoured a circuit breaker lockdown in order to avoid catastrophic consequences. And of course, we did have a delayed lockdown in November, but after cases had been allowed to soar and deaths with them, and scientists had warned, despite the fact Dido Hardung and others said a new variant wasn't predicted. Well, actually, it was made repeatedly clear by scientists that if you allow a virus to widely circulate, the odds of new variants emerging obviously increases, which is what's happened not just here, but obviously in other countries like Brazil, India, and other countries as well. And we know back then that Rishi Sunak in particular, the Chancellor, was heavily pushing against lockdown and invited to number 10 anti-lockdown scientists who have been discredited at every single juncture of the crisis, but they were given a platform. And they had a big role in convincing Boris Johnson as well to delay the lockdown with catastrophic consequences. Rishi Sunak did it on the basis of defending the economy, but as we know, you allow a public health crisis to get out of control, you end up with the worst consequences for the government. So it was completely, self-defeating on its own terms. What do you think about that in terms of what, you know, the potential, I suppose? He's talking about lots of documents and emails that could be quite damning about that, about the lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what he has. He may have a kind of smoking gun that is very damaging for the Prime Minister. But in a sense, we don't really need Dominic Cummings to tell us that the Prime Minister and Rishi Sunak were reluctant to go into lockdown in the autumn and reluctant to go this time last year into lockdown. We know we saw with our own eyes the Prime Minister saying that he was going around shaking everybody's hands and in hospitals, and we didn't need to go into immediate lockdown. So I think I don't want to sort of downplay the significance of Dominic Cummings too much, and he may well have some very damaging allegations. But also, I think there is a kind of credibility issue here with Dominic Cummings in that he is a sort of deeply unpopular figure in the country. His approval rating is something like -67. And he does have a record of saying things which aren't necessarily backed up by the evidence. I mean, some, in particular, his claims about his own breach of lockdown and driving to Barnard Castle to have an eye test, for example. And Boris Johnson himself, of course, has got a record. He was sacked twice for lying. So you have these two public figures, both of whom have been known to breach the truth in the past, both making allegations about each other. And I think the danger is that the public just kind of switch off, and whatever they thought about Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson before, they still think about him now.
Yeah, I mean, Dominic Cummings as well edited his blog to make it look like he'd predicted the pandemic as well. Anyway, but I mean, that last point that you just made, you know, the polling today shows that about 40% of the electorate think the Tories are corrupt. The Tory lead has just gone up at the same time. They've got an 11-point lead, which would deliver a pretty similar result to what I think we can all agree was a catastrophic rout for the Labour Party back in December 2019. What does that tell us?
Well, I think it is significant that such a large chunk of the population believe their Prime Minister is corrupt. 37%, that is a large, it's a minority, but it's a significant minority. So I do think that is important. But as you say, it doesn't seem to be translating into a reduction in Boris Johnson's own personal ratings and more importantly, the headline voting intention in the polls. However, what we do know is that these things do tend to be kind of lagging indicators. And these kind of perception, the kind of public perceptions of governments do take a long time to change. And it is like an oil tanker, you know. It will take a long time. And the volume of these stories and the kind of range of these stories that are coming out week after week over time, that may have an impact on how the public see Boris Johnson. And in that same poll, we saw that people do have a more favourable opinion of the trustworthiness of Keir Starmer. And again, that hasn't translated into headline voting intentions, but it may well do over time. So I think it's possible. But I think the reason it hasn't changed so far is that the public already know that, or already have this perception that politicians are in it for themselves. And this goes back, you know, not just to the expenses scandal, but, you know, way back into the 90s with the cash for questions. So there's been a sort of long running public perception that politicians are close to big business and are in it for themselves and are sort of profiting themselves. And I'm not sure that this current scandal is really doing anything more than kind of confirming people's already perceptions they've already got.
Danger, that's a danger, obviously, isn't it? That fuels an anti-politics mood that rather than people
yes,
being...
And Labour could end up being caught up in it as well. I mean, people look back at the New Labour years and there was similar stories about New Labour's relationship with the corporate world and lobbyists. And indeed, some of those figures are still around today and advising Keir Starmer as well.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, today, Paul Williams, the Labour candidate in Hartlepool, has released a video of Peter Mandelson, who is the former MP, to be fair, for Hartlepool. I mean, again, not the most popular politician in the country, if you're looking at the polling, Peter Mandelson. No. So I don't think you'd use Peter Mandelson as an attempt to tap into votes you otherwise wouldn't be able to get. But, I mean, Peter Mandelson is obviously involved in that whole world of lobbying. What do you think? I mean, what are your thoughts about that in terms of Labour attacks?
I mean, this question came up in a briefing with Keir Starmer's advisers last week, and they refused to be drawn on the relationship between Keir Starmer and Peter Mandelson. But of course, look, if you're making the central issue of your campaign in these local elections conservative sleaze, and you're saying they're all in it together and, you know, questioning their involvement with lobbyists, you've got to be cleaner than clean yourself. And being involved with somebody like Peter Mandelson, who has his own interests and has his own record, as we've just discussed, it's not really the most advisable. And it's probably a relationship that Keir Starmer doesn't really need to be having at this time.
Peter Mandelson, of course, had to resign twice from government. Let's not forget. Yeah. Just on generals, just a couple of general things. I mean, as I've said, the polling is not good for Labour and it has been gradually tanking. I mean, since November, now, obviously, what the Labour leadership are very keen to push is this is a vaccine bounce. Though it is important to note that the decline, both of Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, began before the rollout of the vaccination. And also today's poll shows the Tory lead going up, even though the Tory share of the vote has gone down. So it's more complicated because obviously the Labour vote, you know, if it was just a vaccine boost, it would just be a transfer, presumably, from Labour to Tory, and that's not happening. The Liberal Democrats, the Greens are also benefiting, for example. I mean, what do you think about, you know, because what Labour, I suppose, did, that they bet the house on was competence. New management was supposed to, you know, we're not Jeremy Corbyn, we're competent in contrast to his administration, and obviously in contrast to Boris Johnson as well. The vaccine rollout incinerated that really as a dividing line, because if you go on incompetence, people will go, well, the vaccine rollout's gone well. So instead of going on values and vision, they went for competence, which has blown away really. So what do you think is going wrong for Labour? What they're getting right, but why do you think they're not cutting through in the way they, to be honest, they did expect? They thought with the grown-ups back in the room and things will fall into place, and they haven't.
Well, I think for a while it did work. The kind of competence angle did work for them. I think throughout most of last year, that did work when the government's COVID response was pretty catastrophic. It did have an effect in the polls, and Labour did seem to benefit from that. But I always found their strategy was quite passive. You know, simply saying, "Oh, we should lock down sooner," and then sort of congratulating themselves when Boris Johnson finally agreed to lock down in November. I think that only takes you so far. You have to have something that you're offering to voters. And I think people gave Keir Starmer and the Labour Party the benefit of the doubt for a period after he became Labour leader. We're now sort of a year on, and people are starting to look, actually, we've got these local elections coming up. People are actually looking and saying, well, what are you offering that is different from the current government? We understand what the government have done. We understand that things are getting better with the vaccine rollout, but what are you actually offering that's different? And so far there's been very little. And also there does seem to be this, I mean, we've seen they've been a bit more aggressive in the last couple of weeks over this lobbying scandal, but there has been this kind of reluctance on Labour's part to really sort of taking the government on, opposing them. And there's very sort of, they seem almost timid to take on the government in Parliament and in the wider world as well. And I think that we've seen that's starting to have an effect now on the polls, where Labour's support is starting to go to other parties on the left and also to the Conservatives as well.
Finally, what do you think would be a good night for Labour in the elections a week on Thursday? I'm going to Hartlepool myself tomorrow to do a video, talk to some of the candidates. I haven't heard back from Labour yet, which is hilarious, but I have the kids will see if they let me speak to Paul Williams. Slightly bizarre situation if they're now denying access to left of centre journalists. But anyway, it's not just Hartlepool. Actually, I think these are the biggest elections outside of a general election since the war, because obviously we have the elections from last year, which were delayed, including in London. So we have Scotland, we have mayoralties, we have local elections, we have Wales. What do you think a good result might be for Labour? And what would a bad result look like? And leading on to that, if it does go badly, how much do you think there are genuine murmurings of discontent in the parliamentary Labour Party? After my own soundings, but I'm interested in your own thoughts on that. You know, how secure do you think his leadership actually is in the months ahead if it doesn't go well?
Well, look, we've had the Conservatives in power since, in one form or another, since 2010. You would expect at this stage for an opposition party, particularly under a renewed leader who had a honeymoon period, to be making substantial gains in these kinds of elections. I think it's more likely than not that the Labour will make some gains, but I suspect that they will probably be fairly underwhelming compared to what they you would expect at this kind of period in the electoral cycle. If they actually don't make gains, or they make losses and they lose the by-election in Hartlepool, that's going to be pretty disastrous. There's been some attempts to kind of manage expectations about that, but there's no real way around that. That would be a disastrous result for Labour.
And do you think, I mean, just finally, do you think there's any sense of manoeuvrings going on in the parliamentary Labour Party?
I think by and large, Labour MPs, Keir Starmer is still very popular with Labour MPs. There are some, including among some of his supporters, some of the people who backed him to be leader, who have become increasingly uncomfortable with what they see as his reluctance to go on the front foot against the government. And also there is some murmurings about his reluctance to speak out on the issue of Brexit, which of course he was closely associated with in the past. But him and his team seem incredibly reluctant to talk about now. So there are murmurings, but whether or not, I don't really think that they really are much beyond that. I don't think there are any sort of serious considerations of ousting him as leader at this point.
That's great. Really, really appreciate it. Do follow Adam Biankov on social media and his brilliant articles, which are always very, very insightful and thoughtful and very educational. So thank you, honestly, Adam. Really appreciate it. Very short notice on a Sunday. And I look forward to seeing you maybe in real life or pint at some point.
You too.
Take care, buddy. Great. That was, I think, very, very comprehensive indeed. Brilliant guest who gave us a huge amount of insight into what's going on. Now, as I've said, I'm going to Hartlepool tomorrow. Well, it depends when you're listening or watching, I suppose. But I'm going on Monday. I'm going to be speaking to a range of people from the Reform Party candidate, who is obviously the Continuity Brexit Party, to the North... Not, I don't know, I'm not laughing, it's just an interesting phenomenon, the Northern Independence Party. Obviously, we've interviewed their founder on the channel and the podcast. But what I'm also doing is talking to people on the ground. And what I'm interested in, and I think this is important when we're looking at what happened in the so-called Red Wall, which is often spoken about, without getting a bit chippy as a plastic Northerner, by lots of Southern-based journalists who I think sometimes... Not all, some great journalists from the South, but there's a bit of a kind of going on safari on the North, isn't there? In the North kind of vibe amongst some. And that's to make it this, the Red Wall is this homogenous entity, which of course it isn't. And it's complicated what's happened in those seats because, if you take Hartlepool, Hartlepool in 2015 became a very marginal seat. That was obviously when Ed Miliband was leader, very bad election result for Labour in 2015. And Hartlepool became a marginal and it had a very big then UKIP vote. But in 2017, what was interesting is Hartlepool was one of the seats that the Tories, at the beginning of the general election, people thought Theresa May could walk on water. She, the whole world was before her. She had very, very high approval ratings, not least in those seats. And they looked at the UKIP tally from 2015 and thought, well, they're just going straight to the Conservatives. And that's why seats like Hartlepool will fall into the lap of the Conservatives. That didn't happen in 2017. What did happen in lots of those seats is the Tory vote went up, but so did the Labour Party vote. And what happened in Hartlepool actually is the Labour Party won the biggest majority in vote share since 2001 when Labour won a national landslide. And that was because a lot of the UKIP vote actually transferred over to the Labour Party. Now, in 2019, a lot of those voters then went to the Brexit Party, which got a very big vote. And it went back to being like in 2015, a marginal. But I should say it's still not as marginal as it was in 2015. So actually, a lot of people go, well, the only reason Labour kept the seat back in 2019 was because of the Brexit Party, who split the anti-Labour vote. But actually, a lot of those were Labour voters who voted for Labour under Jeremy Corbyn in 2017 and obviously went off him and the Labour Party. But equally, Jeremy Corbyn inherited Hartlepool as a marginal seat and increased the vote share in 2017 and still managed to keep it on a better vote share than 2015 in 2019. So I suppose, if Keir Starmer loses that seat, and I think it's unlikely, by the way, I think it's very important to say that because oppositions just don't lose by-elections. It's only happened twice in the last 50 years. Labour have a very good get-out-the-vote campaign. And I think the sleaze stuff will filter in. It might depress some of the Tory vote so it doesn't come out and vote. But actually, obviously, which shouldn't be in question. It's a by-election. I mean, in by-elections, opposition is supposed to do better than general elections. So it would be terrible if Labour lost that seat. But I am interested in the trends. So what's happened in places like Hartlepool, and we often talk about this as a class issue, but actually it's so much to do with age and generation, because in seats like Hartlepool, the number of people over 65 has massively increased in the last 20, 30 years. And the number of people under 25, younger people, has decreased. And that's often because there isn't often the jobs there for them. So they go elsewhere. They take their Labour votes with them and they vote Labour often in safe Labour seats. I was chatting to someone who left Hartlepool, who's 25, who lives in Leeds. They vote Labour. They're not voting Labour in Hartlepool. And then you often get older homeowners who are sometimes relatively affluent. I mean, that's the other point. This idea of the Red Wall just being this, a sea of deprivation is not true. You've got actually suburbs there with, gated communities and so on, new builds where people are relatively well off. So I think it's an interesting picture. So I want to look at the complexities, you know, not to do a video which is poverty porn, but actually to look at the complexities of communities like Hartlepool, what it all means for Labour going forward, whoever's leader, because these are underlying trends that have been going on for a very long time under New Labour, Ed Miliband, Corbyn, and now Starmer. So I want to be really rigorous and do a really thoughtful video. But you make those videos possible. We pay a brilliant videographer on a union wage to film and edit it. And that's how we did the COVID-19 catastrophe documentary. It's how we've done documentaries about everything from anti-lockdown protesters to businesses that have profited from COVID-19. You make that possible on patreon.com/owenjones84. So we really appreciate it. Leave a review and 5 stars if you want to encourage other people to listen to the podcast too. We've got loads of interviews. Now, last week we interviewed, I would say, a range of people. We interviewed Robert Lindsay and Jamie Carragher. Do check out those interviews. And next week we are interviewing a range of people, including Lord Buckethead, not joking, two brilliant American journalists and pundits to talk about Joe Biden and the United States. We are also talking to, let me bring up, we're talking to Hanan Ashrari, who is a senior Palestinian politician, about what's going on in Palestine at the moment. Some horrendous scenes the other day of extremists from Israel marching through occupied Palestine, yelling death to Arabs and attacking Palestinian civilians. So we're going to be talking about the situation there as well. So we've got a very, as I said, a very diverse range of things. But we also have our show next Sunday at 12 o'clock as ever. That is all for me and for my brilliant guests. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you for making this channel possible. As I say, do subscribe, like, and I will see you very soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.